Coming up today, a giant security flaw scanning millions of dead creatures in Iran's social media block. You're listening to episode 350 of the Wired UK podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech, ideas, business and design. I'm your host Matt Burgess, and joining me this week are Matt Reynolds.
Hello.
And Victoria Turk.
Hello.
Happy New Year to you both.
Happy New Year.
Yeah, Happy New Year.
Yeah. I know I've seen you all week, but I just felt like it would be a nice little, just like spread some goodwill.
Yeah, Happy New Year to
you've
listeners.
Had all, oh yeah, I guess as well. Yeah, Happy New Year to everybody out there listening. You've had 2 weeks or the whole festive break to come up with something that you've learned. So there's no excuses for not having something really good this week. Vicky, what have you learned over Christmas and the New Year break?
I mean, if by over Christmas and the New Year break you mean this morning, I learned that in the UK, people use 2.5 billion disposable coffee cups every year.
That is a lot.
2.5 billion. It's a real lot. So this is in the news at the moment because of a proposed latte levy, which would basically add 25p to the cost of a hot drink if you use a disposable cup. And this is obviously being brought in for environmental reasons. 500 of these cups are thrown away every minute in the UK. And even if you think that you're not throwing it away, you're putting it in the recycling, the reality is that fewer than one in 400 are actually recycled because most recycling plants don't have the facility to split the paper from the kind of plastic coating. So
that's pretty terrible. Reusable cups, they're the way forward.
Yeah, so, you know, I think that is a good New Year's resolution for anyone out there who hasn't got one yet. Get your little reusable cup. Save the world.
Yeah, I think you get like 50p off coffee at Pret if you use a... Obviously, other coffee chains do the same as well. But you get like money off your coffee if you use a reusable cup. So it seems quite, you know, economic too.
Yeah. Save the world, save money.
Yeah.
That's the plan. Matt, what have you learned this week?
So I learned this week that Neanderthals... had kind of raspy, high-pitched voices. So I guess we kind of think that, I don't know, they sound kind of like gruff or they grunt, kind of like, you know, the stereotypical caveman. But actually they had really kind of like childlike, high-pitched, raspy voices. So we think we know from a kind of like analysis of their kind of their trachea and their throat area.
Can you do an impression voice?
Yeah, go on.
Okay, what should I say in Neanderthal?
Happy New Year?
Happy New Year!
Is that 100% scientifically accurate?
Oh, yeah. That's we reanimated. It's completely accurate.
I actually thought there was a Neanderthal in the room.
I know.
Sorry to anybody who's lost an eardrum because of that. What did I learn this week? I learned that there are lots of new things on the Guinness World Records website. And particularly, I learned that a man smashed 122 coconuts with his fist in 60 seconds. Which
wow.
is quite
I'm
impressive.
I'm genuinely impressed.
There's a video of it, just basically a man punching loads of coconuts on a wall, and it's like, it's...
But coconuts are really hard. That must have really hurt.
I don't know how you do one.
No, just have a lot of force. He looks a little bit crazed when he's doing it. I watched a video and it's just like, just bang,
is it
bang,
just
bang.
One fist he uses?
Yeah, pretty much, I think. I wasn't paying that much attention, but it's a sight to behold.
Yeah.
Wow, don't try that at home.
No, I don't know why you would try it anyway.
I don't know where you'd get a coconut from, either. You know, I don't know.
It has to be in the season in the UK. Well, they only have them in certain times of the year in the UK, don't they?
I don't think I've ever seen a coconut in a shop.
Okay, we both...
Is that not a thing?
You lived under a rock, you are.
They sell coconuts in the shops. Go and look for them. That's
cool.
Your task for this weekend. But first up, this week, Matt, you've been reporting around what's been going on in Iran, where obviously there are some where there are protests going on at the moment. So what's been happening that sort of makes it relevant to us, and why are we talking about it now?
Yeah, so these protests that broke out at the end of December, like about December 28th, and just give a little bit of background, these kind of protests are around, there's been like really long-term high unemployment in Iran, they've got a very young population, and it's kind of like economically kind of stagnated. So this isn't, you know, a revolutionary political thing necessarily, it's kind of like very kind of like significant discontent, right? So we'd had this protest that's been going on, you know, at the end of the year, and basically this kind of, it bubbled over into loads of towns, tens of thousands of people, and basically on New Year's Eve, the Iranian government shut off the access to loads of really major social media sites in Iran. They shut off Telegram, the kind of encrypted messaging services, and Instagram and Signal, which is another encrypted messenger. So, you know, Iran has a massive history of filtering the internet and blocking stuff, but this was a very clear attempt to try and stop people using these things to organise.
So it's blocking social media. It's been, as well as the protests that have been going on and sort of the deaths that have happened because of these protests, the government have been trying to shut down communications, or has shut down communications to try and quell the protests. Is that about right?
Yeah, exactly. And to kind of give it a little bit more context, you know, I think that in the UK, and you know, in societies that are lucky enough to be fairly free, we don't use secure messengers necessarily. I mean, I know WhatsApp is encrypted and stuff, but we don't use messengers that put security right at the heart of their thing. And that's the whole thing about Telegram. It's kind of a secure encrypted messenger. So the idea is no state or any other onlooker can kind of see what you're doing. In Iran, 40 million people use it every month, which is unbelievably huge. That's half the population, right? It's just over 80 million people in Iran, and 21 million of them use it every single day. So, you know, this is like putting WhatsApp offline. But it's, you know, very specifically what makes Telegram unique is that you also have kind of channels where you kind of subscribe to someone and you will just see a kind of thread of them, you know, putting out messages, putting out video, putting out whatever images. And a lot of these are used to kind of say, well, we're going to be at this place here, or even, you know, messages of solidarity, stuff like this person's missing, you know, don't forget this person's still in prison. Like all this kind of stuff is organized around these Telegram channels.
So effectively, because of the regime and because of the oppressiveness of Iran and the politics and everything that goes on there, more people are using an encrypted messenger on purpose rather than necessarily. Most people who use WhatsApp in the UK don't necessarily, they're not using it because it is, because it uses end-to-end encryption. I guess one of my big questions and what you were looking at is like, how does a government shut this off? Like, surely it shouldn't be able to.
So I looked a bit into this, and interestingly, when you have an internet that is as tightly controlled and tightly centrally controlled as the Iranian internet is, it's actually super easy. So basically, the government-backed authorities, the government really itself, kind of like controls where the internet kind of like comes into the country, the kind of very physical, you know, pipes and stuff like that. And they basically have kind of filtering at that level. So as soon as that internet comes in, they have certain IP addresses. So certain sites are just completely blacklisted, you know, stuff like Facebook and Twitter, and YouTube, loads and loads of resources that, you know, are really kind of like common. So they can really be blocked at that kind of state level. What's interesting, I spoke to some people at the Oxford Internet Institute, and they basically said, you know, we think of filtering perhaps as something that is done by like these kind of authoritarian regimes, but you know, internet filtering is actually like the norm as opposed to the exception. In the UK, you can't access sites, obviously, that have like child pornography and stuff like that, incredibly extreme and illegal content. And how it's done in the UK is that an internet watchdog basically gives our internet service providers a list, and the internet service providers then put certain IP addresses on that list and say, we're not going to let our customers access that. They do it voluntarily, essentially. In Iran, you've got a similar thing going on, except you can kind of imagine it like, instead of an internet service provider doing it, you've got the state just saying, this is the list. And because they have, you know, such control over how the internet kind of comes in the country, it's really easy for them to just say, you know, let's add another IP address to a list.
So what happens when they shut it down? Does that just mean people can't talk to each other anymore, or is there a way to get around it?
So essentially, I mean, largely, yeah, it means that people can't talk to each other. So there are obviously like VPNs, which kind of like mask your IP address and kind of like suggests you're accessing a site that you're not really accessing, or like the Onion Router, which does a kind of similar thing and kind of like allows you to browse the internet anonymously.
Tor.
And so there are kind of like ways around these, and these are like semi-widely used in Iran. So I was speaking to Josh Wright at the Oxford Internet Institute, and he said around like 12,000 people are using stuff like Tor to access like Telegram on the web and stuff like that. But his kind of point was, when you had 40 million people using Telegram, and then say you have 12,000 people that can then use Tor to kind of get around that, the whole ability to use these platforms and these services as a kind of organizing tool is just completely taken away. He was like, the point isn't that the government can make sure that no one can go on Telegram. It can make sure that 99% of people don't go on Telegram. And what you get is a situation where it becomes practically useless as a tool to communicate or to organize, because the only people that are on it are the people that are savvy enough to have the Onion router or use a VPN. Also, we think that the Iranian government can tell when you're using a VPN anyway, so some of these are like you don't want to flag that you're trying to circumvent the blocks anyway.
And what has been sort of particularly interesting about this case as well, like there have been many social media shutdowns, internet shutdowns by oppressive regimes around the world, and I think the number is generally increasing. But the Iranian government has spoken out quite a bit specifically about Telegram and people using it, and sort of made requests saying that Telegram should block certain accounts or certain things or abide by certain sort of stipulations. And actually, most cases when you see a country shutting down a social media channel or something it doesn't like online, it normally doesn't talk about it too much. It normally doesn't sort of explicitly state these demands or stuff like that, at least not in public. Maybe it does privately, but they've been very public about what they want Telegram to do if they're going to unblock it and ban it. And this sort of leaves Telegram in a very difficult position.
Yeah, totally. So Iran, in fact, even before they kind of blocked it, Iran's ICT minister tweeted at Telegram's founder, a guy called Pavel Durov, and they tweeted saying, a particular channel on Telegram had been inciting its users to kind of use like improvised grenades against police. And the ICT minister basically said, look, this is what this channel is doing. You need to take this channel off. And actually, Telegram did take that offline because they said it violated their terms of service. So they didn't say they did it because the Iranian government asked. But I think you can draw that line, really. But the ICT minister has kind of like continued since the ban on Christmas, on New Year's Eve, has continued to say, unless you take off all these people that are, inciting protests and inciting resistance against the government, we're going to kind of going to keep this ban on Telegram. So you have this really kind of difficult situation that Telegram is in. And it's, do you agree and compromise to the regime's demands, some of which even fall within their own terms of service, right, that shouldn't really be on the platform because they say they don't want violence on the platform, so whether it's justified or not. Do you compromise and go with those demands and keep the service for 40 million people that can still use it? Or do you say, no, like, either, we're not going to do anything the regime says and we're going to keep it independent, and potentially it's blacklisted forever. And, like you said, so people that have a VPN can use it, but not many people do, and it becomes useless. And it's kind of interesting. So you see, it's kind of like a parallel, because like Facebook has been trying, Facebook is banned by China as well. And Facebook has taken a step that is more kind of like compromising. They've tried to make tools that kind of replicate what the Chinese censor does in some kind of way, and it will take some content off Facebook. And they, the argument to that is, well, it's better to have Facebook in some form rather than not have it at all. Whereas Telegram's founder, Durov, has kind of said, actually, we only abide by our own terms of service. We'll remove anything that doesn't, that violates that, but we're not bound, or we won't be bound, to any local law. So basically saying, we're going to keep it completely open, and you do what you do after that. So it's interesting, because there's not really a clear answer, I don't think.
Vicky, I'm going to put you on the spot, and I probably know there's a fairly obvious answer that I imagine you're going to go for in this. If this was your business, and you were in the position of being in the position of Telegram, what sort of action would you take? What would you go for?
Well, I think that is the right line, to just stick to your terms of service and not bend to local governments, especially when you're talking about oppressive regimes like in this situation. I think what we've seen again and again with social media is this problem of, you start off with this platform, everyone's using it as you thought they would, you've got a terms of service, and then suddenly people are using it in different ways. There's a lot more people using it, and you're actually having to enforce your terms of service. And suddenly you realize that maybe there are some holes in those terms of service, and there's lots of gray areas, and there's lots of cases that, could go either way, and it's more subjective than you thought. And you don't have the staff to go through every post and figure out if they comply or not. And, we've seen this with Twitter, we've seen it with Facebook. Most of these sites traditionally kind of rely on users flagging and reporting posts that don't comply. So I think that's probably a bit of the problem here as well. And as you say, with this, the government asking to remove a channel that was inciting people to throw grenades at police, sure, I can see how that would be against the channel's terms of service. But, you know, when you're relying on people to point them out to you, it's tough.
It's scale, isn't it?
It's the practical issue, I think, as much as this sort of ideological decision of, you know, what do we want our company to be, and how do we value reaching people versus sticking to our ideals. And then the very practical issue of how do we actually moderate this content to stick to what we've said we believe in.
And all these problems get amplified when you reach scale, when you're reaching 40 million people, half a population of one country, then the decision you make become even more important than if you were reaching 10 people or 10 million people or whatever. So it's a really difficult position for Telegram to being, and hopefully, well, I think from at least Vicky's and my perspective, and probably yours, Matt, and most people's, Telegram will stick to its principles and say that we're only abiding by our terms and conditions around this. We're not, like, going to work for a... or work towards one regime's idea of what they're doing. That will obviously go on to see what happens there. The protests are still happening, and it's a grave situation in many cases, but also it's people exercising their right to democratic protest and freedom, and freedom of speech and everything around there. So lots more to come probably on that. Mention scale just at the end there, Vicky. Our next story is about scale, but of a very different kind. The Natural History Museum.
Yeah, that was a very tenuous segue. So my story that I'm bringing this week is actually a video that went up on our Wired YouTube channel this week. Check it out, Wired UK YouTube channel. And in this video, we went to the Natural History Museum in London and saw behind the scenes of how they are digitising the 80 million specimens in their collection. So 80 million, huge number of specimens, and basically
scale.
Yeah, as you say, large scale there. And basically they're imaging everything for their kind of digital archives and to make it easier to access and to preserve it digitally for the future. So things like insects to meteorites to, you know, the big blue whale skeletons that you associate with the Natural History Museum. You name it, they are trying to digitize it. And obviously, as you mentioned, Matt, one of the biggest challenges here is just the sheer scale of the challenge. So the project started in 2014, but so far they've only digitized about 5% of the collection, just because there's so much to do. But to help them along the way, they're constantly developing new technologies to make it more efficient and more effective. So for instance, they've written software that lets them image multiple specimens at once. So often you'll have, several things in the same place or in the same exhibit. And using this kind of camera setup, they can image them all, and then the software can like separate that out into separate things. So they can do apparently up to 200 at once now.
Presumably cool. They're fairly small things that they're
doing.
Yeah,
so I imagine that would be more on the insect scale than the blue whale skeleton scale. and they're also always experimenting with different 3D imaging techniques, like X-rays and that kind of thing. So one really cool example that we saw is this anglerfish. Do you know an anglerfish? They're the ones that are at the really deep ocean and they're really ugly looking with the teeth, and you often see them in Blue Planet and things like that. They've got one. And they've known for a while, I think, that there's something inside this fish, but obviously they're not going to chop it open and destroy the specimen, so they never knew what it was. But using imaging, they have revealed that there's another fish inside the fish, and the fish is twice the length of the fish that's eaten it.
Wow.
Is it just like curved back on itself? Yeah. So you can see this beautiful image and you can see like the skeletons of the fish. Do fish have skeletons? Do angler fish have skeletons?
Yeah, I think they do.
Yeah. No, of course they do. Yeah.
Have you never picked the bones
going crazy
of
fish?
Oh, yeah. Like the comedy, the fish head and the tail.
Okay, I was right then. Skeletons. So you can see like inside this fish without actually having to open it up, which is really pretty cool.
And what's their plan to do with all of this stuff once it's digitized? Like, obviously it's going to take a little while, but are they putting it online, or is it just from all their collections and what they're doing within the museum?
Yeah, so basically it's just to make, I guess, a digital version of the collection. So obviously that's a lot easier to refer to for research and that kind of thing. If you think it's kind of equivalent to you know, having one library that contains one or two copies of every book versus being able to go online and download the ebook. You know, for a lot of things you might not actually have to see the physical specimen, you can just look at it digitally. And also, you know, these exhibits are getting older and older, and a lot of them are very fragile, so it's sort of safeguarding a lot of the information about them. And a lot of them have, you know, they're hundreds and hundreds of years old, just since the Natural History Museum has had them, never mind before that. And they've got lots of kind of handwritten labels attached to them, often more than one on the same specimen. And, you know, there's no kind of rigorous, strict filing system. So by taking all that information and digitizing it, it just makes everything a bit easier to sort of sort and search through.
And insects. There's a particular challenge around insects, because obviously we mentioned the really big things, like the blue whale, but it must be completely different, but also very hard when you are dealing with something so small as well.
Yeah, so one of the things that we saw them do is digitize microscope slides with lice on them, which is pretty gross, slash very scientifically interesting, I'm sure. And also, you know, a lot of the insects that they've collected from the past have pins in them, you know, the pinned insects that how people used to display them.
Yeah, I don't know why you would display them on a board with a pin holding the insect.
Yeah,
up,
you know, you see them in antique places and stuff, and it's kind of the conventional way of displaying insects. But you want to be able to image the insects without removing the pin, because obviously removing it could damage the insect. So they've had to come up with like special ways to do that. And yeah, they have managed to do that actually. So they're kind of preserving everything to describe the specimen and safeguard these specimens for the future without causing any damage.
Yeah, it's a really fascinating project, and I think it's going to go on for a few years yet. Because just because of the huge scale of everything that needs to be digitised. And as you mentioned at the beginning of that section there, Vicky, we produced a video with this. We went to the National History Museum, looked at how the digitisation process is working and sort of all the challenges and the really fascinating bits behind it. And you can see that on the Wired YouTube channel, which is youtube.co.uk or .com/WiredUK. Mm-hmm. Or if you just Google our channel, you'll easily be able to find it. And yeah, go check it out. It's a really interesting look at a process that is important for preserving history, but also like informing our knowledge of everything else that has happened in the past, really.
And current scientific research, you know, there's still so much we don't know about a lot of these things, so it's really important work. And subscribe to our YouTube channel as well, because we're producing more and more really awesome videos like this.
And we've done, well, just to give you a flavour of what we've done recently with videos, we've been to the Ferrari's factory. We've looked at their production and how robots are being used to help produce the latest Ferraris. We've been to a fire training centre where the firefighters from all around the world are trained to fight the biggest and the most dangerous blazes. There's loads more that's going on. And
Lego House. I went to see the new Lego House in Billund, Denmark. Yeah, I think I spoke about that on this podcast, actually.
So subscribe to the channel. And for our final story this week before the quiz, there is a quiz. I prepared one, and it's a good one. This week we found out about a giant security vulnerability that has been discovered in basically all of the world's microprocessors inside pretty much every device that we use. So we're talking computers, PCs, we're talking Macs, we're talking phones, we're talking, well, it even affects web browsers and stuff as well. So it's like, it's a giant, like, these security vulnerabilities that get announced seem to get bigger and bigger each time, but this one is practically the biggest so far. It's hard to put it into context, but basically every single chip since 1995 has got a problem with it.
Bit of a facepalm moment, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. So to give you a quick like rundown of what's happened and what people should be doing, so there are two vulnerabilities that have been found. One is called Meltdown and one is called Spectre. So they've been given typically like scary sort of dystopian style names, and Meltdown affects chips made by Intel, and Spectre affects chips made by other companies such as, and designed by other companies as well, such as ARM and AMD. So all the big chip manufacturers have got this this problem, and the problem basically is that in the sort of compromise between speed and security, speed has sort of been favored in recent years in chips, and because of this, if this vulnerability is exploited, so if somebody actually goes out and tries to hack your machine in this way, the chip can actually access, or software or acting through the chip will be able to access memory and data stored by other applications that are running. So if you are, if you've got your emails open and somebody runs this, uses an exploit around the vulnerability, they will be able to sort of take all the information from your emails or your passwords or whatever you've got running at the time on the computer. So it's basically a permission sort of bypass, which there's loads of technical stuff into it, and you can go and read into that if you want to, but basically it's not good.
Yeah, Matt Burgess's hot take.
Yeah, it sounds pretty bad. So is this basically all devices? Are we basically using devices now that have got this vulnerability?
Yeah, so I think that one of the important things to stress is that it's a vulnerability that's been found by researchers. There haven't been so far any cases of this being found, being used, exploited in the wild. So nobody has found Russian hackers or anybody of this sort of disposition actually using or making exploiting these vulnerabilities. So it exists in the devices, but it's not actually being no data has been stolen or anything like that, as far as we know. Like, it's very hard to detect, and they both operate slightly differently, but they are both like not easy to find in the same sort of way that ransomware would lock your computer and flash something up on your screen. So if somebody has been using it, it's a fairly they would have to be fairly sophisticated and kept it under wraps for a very long time, so it's probably unlikely that it has been used. I wouldn't be surprised, that said, if in the next few weeks we find out somebody was trying to use this against computers or things like that. So it's on pretty much all devices, so vendors included include the chip manufacturers, Apple, Google, Intel, Linux, Microsoft, Mozilla, and pretty much everything that is existing. So it does sound very bad, but in reality, I would say that people's the chance of it being used against people is probably fairly low. Like, if you are working in a corporate organization or you have lots of sensitive information, secretive information that might be targeted, then that is probably more likely to be for people to try and exploit if they can find out this. But like your average day-to-day person, like my mum browsing Facebook on her iPad, she's probably not going to be targeted if somebody does develop and use this in a malicious way.
So what can people do? Are there patches? Are people coming out of updates to fix it?
Yeah, that is it. So for Meltdown in particular, there is a patch that will sort of mitigate a lot of the problems. For Spectre, they haven't actually found a proper fix for this yet. So there are mitigations, apparently, which involve sort of a lot of technical configurations being changed and things like that, but there is no way to sort of fully fix Spectre without replacing all the chips that are being used, which is very unlikely, because manufacturers aren't going to replace the chips in iPhones and ship new devices or change every single device. So this is going to be around for a long time, but as we said, there's no sort of exploits been developed yet for it, and it's the main thing for people to do, as with any single vulnerability, is update things. So Apple, in their iOS and their OS latest versions, have said that there's mitigations involved in them. Microsoft has already released one. Google has patched like its servers and its the cloud sort of infrastructure that is running on these chips as well. So you should always obviously update devices as soon as possible, but now even more so. So for most people, it's just business as normal. If you work in probably an IT department in a big corporate organization that's got a lot of infrastructure, it might be slightly different for you, but you should know what you're doing anyway.
Be nice to your IT people if they're walking around with that little bit more stress on their shoulders right now.
Yeah, and update all your devices. So that's Spectre and Meltdown. Like, this is only just been released this week. Like, people have known about it for a little while and been trying to fix it in the background, but the sort of disclosure of it only happened this week. And I wouldn't be surprised, as I say, if we see going forward more people sort of saying, oh, we may have found an instance of this being used, but that hasn't happened as yet. So fingers crossed it won't. But we're going to end with a quiz today. And as it's the first one of the new year, and in particular because Mark Zuckerberg yesterday posted on Facebook that his new year resolution is to fix Facebook, which, I mean...
Good luck with that one.
Yeah, there's a lot that he has to fix. But I'm going to go do a quiz about Facebook this week.
Ooh.
And how much do you know about the company and some of its products and services over the years?
Yeah. Not much.
We'll see. Okay, five questions. First one. Who was the first face on Facebook?
Mark Zuckerberg? Is that too easy?
I'm going to say the one of the other guys, Dustin. I can't remember his last name. It's like Dustin Makovitz or something. Dustin.
No.
Oh.
It was Al Pacino.
What? What do you mean the first face? I don't...
So on Facebook, the logo...
Yeah.
Initially had a face in a sort of binary design, so a face made up of all like ones and zeros,
right.
And it was Al Pacino's face.
Cool. I guess that says a lot about the people who designed Facebook.
It's your dorm room poster.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that was a bit of that was a tricky one. You wouldn't have ever got that. So. I'm sorry.
Thanks, Mark.
The like button didn't used to be called the like button while it was being developed and before it was sort of released publicly. What do you know what the name for it was? Or can you have a guess at what the name for it was? And it's... I'll give you some clues because, again, it's quite a hard one. So Facebook was accused of stealing it, the like button from FriendFeed. That's just background information. But in the development, a thumbs up was considered or... Not considered, but they were debated. Do we use a thumbs up? Do we use a stars? Do we use a plus sign? All positive things, and it's sort of in that vein and very. It's an Americanism, which I think they toned down a little bit to be used around the world. The like, so.
Did that help you at all, Matt?
No, I yeah.
I realised when I was saying that these are not clues. These are just
so
the
like
notes
an American
I've
version
down.
Of like.
You know what I love?
Like rad.
That's not a million miles off.
I think I love how you said like they were accused of stealing the like button from like FriendFeed, because now you think like the like button, it's just, you know, everywhere has a like button, right? You know, like, you know, Argos reviews and whatever. I just find it fascinating that they're like, that's a pretty unique idea there. I'm gonna say it was like awesome. The button.
Vicky, do you want to change rad or do you want to?
I can't think.
Yeah, it's really hard.
Well, it doesn't matter anyway because Matt's got it right.
Oh,
it was awesome.
What? And did it? Was it like a what was it? Like a symbol or what?
I'm not sure fully what okay. It was, but they were developing it, and pretty much the idea until quite late in the process, from what I've read, was awesome.
I you know what? It's funny actually because they've kind of gone back to that now. They have the different expressions and stuff. Like, it sounds unbelievably annoying actually that would just be the default option.
Yeah. Well, it's.
I've
expanded.
Got a story for you. Speaking of annoying old artifacts of Facebook. Someone poked me this week.
What?
Like
I didn't
a
think that
stranger.
Existed.
I know. I didn't even realize that feature was still a thing. Just a random dude, and it was just like so and so poked you on Facebook or whatever.
Wow.
It is.
I wonder if that's come from like 2005 or something.
I know. I was shocked.
I should have had a question about pokes. I haven't got one, but I'm gonna give you the next one now. So Facebook now has more than 2 billion monthly users. When it launched in Harvard as a school project or a school connection network originally. And that was in February 2004. How long did it take to reach its first 1 million or to hit 1 million users? And it was still a school's network at the time, or university's network.
Wait, so it launched 2004?
February 2004.
Yeah, I don't know. For some reason, I have this kind of like weird sense that it's like... was like an instant hit, but I don't know if that's right. Are you asking, like, so how many, was it like months or years?
Go for a date.
Oh, but what point did it reach a million? And so the date it was launched was...
February 2004.
I'm going to say by August 2005 it had a million.
Vicky, any...
Yeah, I was going to say about 2 years, so February 2006.
Matt, you get the... you get the point for that one. It was December 2004, so it was
that's so soon,
less than a year. Which, I mean, if you look at like apps,
no, wait, I get the point.
you said 2 years.
Yeah,
you said February 2006.
Oh yeah, no, you're right. Yeah. Sorry, I got my maths wrong. I don't know the months.
God, we were going to have to put that towards the independent judging panel. I've been tricky.
No, you're right. I was wrong. I'm sorry.
December 2004, which was very quick for apps and well websites at the time. Next question. After the 2012 election, Barack Obama posted a photo hugging his wife, Michelle, with the comment, 4 more years. How many likes did it get? At the time, it was the most liked photo.
How many awesomes did it get?
How many awesomes did it get? I don't know if it's still
idea.
The most...
So there's...
Yeah, I'm totally living in the past. And I think that you know, that Ellen DeGeneres tweet is still the most popular tweet, but it's like, not anymore, is it? Like, we've really moved on from those times.
Yeah, things change.
Yeah.
So 2 billion monthly users.
This is 2012, though, so
it was... 2012, so it would be, say, 1 billion by then?
Yeah, roughly.
How many of them would like Barack and Michelle Obama getting into, well... Barack Obama getting back into office.
Come on, it's a number. It's in the millions.
Okay.
I need a guess.
20 million.
I'm going to say, like, 60 million.
Ooh, Vicky, you're back in it.
Yes.
2-1 to Matt. It was 4 million likes. 4.4 million likes. It's probably got more since then.
I swear,
then,
like, the chicken nugget tweet got more than that.
I got that. The state of the world.
Okay, final question. Vicky, you can tie it up, or Matt, you can take home the victory. And it's another number guessing one.
Oh, great.
According to one piece of analysis done in 2016, and at the time Facebook had 1.6 billion users, when will the number of dead people on Facebook overtake the amount of living people?
Oh, that's good.
I feel like I remember seeing this, but I have no idea which year it was.
Yeah, we're obviously looking for a year, so...
Oh, that's really tricky.
And it might have changed now that the numbers are bigger. We're going off the 2016 analysis that was done.
It's so weird. It's like, well, I'm trying to think, like, what's the average age of someone on Facebook? And then maybe, you know, in 40 years. Oh, that I'm going to... So you're saying, by what year will there be more dead people on Facebook than there are alive people?
Yeah.
Than there are alive people now?
No, the alive people using Facebook.
Oh.
I'm going to say 2060. No, that seems too soon. No, maybe not. 2060.
I could not have less of a frame of reference. I just have no idea. I'm going to say 2102.
Matt, you take this week's quiz.
It was 2102.
No, it wasn't. Oh. It was 2098. Apparently.
Ah.
So yeah, apparently around 10,000 or 8,000 people who are using Facebook every single day. I know the company's changed a few things about how people can sort of give their profiles to their relatives and stuff, but I'm sure there's lots that just sort of get left there as memorials and things like that. And yeah, it's a bit of a morbid end to the quiz.
Imagine what, you know, in 2098 we're all still on Facebook. You know, that's a, you know, reassuring future, isn't it?
It is. You'll be preserved. That'll be your legacy.
Yeah. Oh, there you go. that's cheery.
Yeah, that's a good end to the start of the new year. That'll be it for this week's podcast then. Thank you for listening. Thank you for joining us, Matt and Vicky. And we'll be back next week, hopefully with something a bit cheerier.
Awesome.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.